Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Right now, on Last Call.
We're in one of these periods where I don't think many people know exactly what's going to happen.
Rare comments from hedge fund titan Steve Cohen. What is coming next for your money? We'll get reaction from Tom Lee. Victory for now. Disney's brutal board battle ending, but an even tougher chapter may have just begun. Critical stakes in China. Janet Yellen preparing to meet with its top leaders. Kyle Bass joining us on what they need to hear. Living in Levi's, shares are soaring, and you will hear exclusively from the CEO. And the craze around DJT shares somehow gets even crazier. We've got numbers you gotta see. And swallow this. Driverless food delivery has arrived in one major city, and the robots, they're not trying your fries. All that and more over the hour, so belly up or buckle up, because Last Call is up right now. Well, good evening here. Good afternoon out west, everybody. I am Brian Sullivan. All that and more coming up in our hour. But first up on Last Call, interest rates and your money. Earlier today, Fed Chair Jerome Powell threw some cold water on the possibility that borrowing costs would come down sooner rather than later.
We do not expect that it will be appropriate to lower our policy rate until we have greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably down toward 2%. Given the strength of the economy and progress on inflation so far, we have time to let the incoming data guide our decisions on policy.
Now, those comments did not seem to shock investors. Yeah, the Dow closed a little bit in the red, but the S&P 500 bounced back from a two-day slump. Still, interest rates are weighing on investors. The 10-year Treasury yield did tick a little bit lower today, but still hovering pretty much right at its highest level of the year. While Fed officials are confident at getting inflation down to 2%, others are a little less optimistic. This morning on Squawk Box, hedge fund legend and New York Mets owner Stephen Cohen said it would be difficult for the Fed to get inflation back down to its 2% goal. But despite his concerns on inflation, the billionaire believes that the Federal Reserve will eventually cut rates.
I think the market expects three cuts. I think that's the number. I don't disagree with that. I think inflation's been, somewhat contained.
But another famed hedge fund manager has a bit of a different take. Here's what Greenlight Capital's David Einhorn told Scott Wapner.
How many times are they going to cut this year?
I think fewer than are priced in right now.
So fewer than three?
Sure.
You think they cut? You think there's a chance they don't do anything?
There's a chance. I think inflation is reaccelerating. I think there's a lot of indication of that.
All right, so different views, both really successful guys. Who might be right? Let's talk about it with another guy who's pretty successful in his own right. That is Tom Lee. He is the managing partner and head of research at Fundstrat. If you had to go on Team Cohen, which I guess is the Mets, and Team Einhorn, like I'll call that the Brewers because he's from Milwaukee, which team would you be on, Tom Lee?
Well, I hope I don't get judged, but I'd be on the Team Mets and Cohen.
Why is that? Lay it out.
Well, I think that the reason the idea of cuts was being rolled back was the January and February inflation reports globally showed inflation was accelerating. And part of that is a statistical aberration. There's just some really poor seasonal adjustments that take place. The March CPI reports coming out of Europe have shown a big collapse from those January, February levels. Like Eurozone, it's back to 2.4%. The March CPI for the US is coming out next week, which is April 10th. And by the time the Fed meets in June, there's going to be a total of three inflation reports, March, April, May. I think by then, markets are going to be a lot more confident that inflation is falling and the three cuts actually may be too low. You know, there's a possibility there's more than three cuts this year.
Okay. Wow. I tweeted out a poll yesterday, and I think we might get less or maybe none, but that's why you do what you do, and I sit here on this side of the camera, Tom. If we get one cut, if we get two cuts, if we get three cuts, if we get four cuts, does that change your end-of-year S&P target? I mean, does another half a percentage point off the Fed funds rate matter to the S&P 500 in the short term?
Brian, I think the number of cuts won't matter as much as the reason the Fed is titrating its cuts. If the Fed is titrating its cuts because the economy is showing resilience, so it's strong, but not necessarily inflationary, I think the market would take that as quite dovish, because it's really a Fed trying to manage the business cycle. If the Fed is cutting back its number of cuts because inflation is reaccelerating, that would actually be incrementally bearish. So I think that the rationale actually is more important than the number of cuts.
Okay, well said. Tom, I want to switch gears a bit. The Federal Reserve, we've been focused on inflation for 3 years, but the Federal Reserve's dual mandate also looks at job growth. And a new article today in the Wall Street Journal highlights a rather curious trend in the difference between the two ways that the federal government measures employment. And if you read between the lines in the Journal's article, it implies that much of our recent job growth, maybe a majority of it, is due to immigration. Much of that, of course, would be undocumented immigration and those seeking asylum. In fact, the CBO, Tom, just raised population growth estimates to account for the millions who have crossed the border in the last few years. Leaving out all political arguments about the border, we're talking about the markets here. Do we care? And Morgan Stanley alluded to the same issue kind of yesterday. Do we care where the job growth really comes from when we're looking at markets and the Fed?
Brian, objectively, it's actually a good thing, because we know the Phillips curve's kind of been busted. That's supposed to measure unemployment rates and wage inflation. And we've had unemployment sort of pinned at these levels and wage inflation isn't accelerating. So it shows that we're adding jobs, we're adding to the worker supply, and actually adding to aggregate demand without creating inflation. And on balance, that's quite positive. And does it matter where this labor supply is being filled? It's a great question. But as you know, I mean, the U.S. is essentially a nation of immigrants anyway. So I don't think necessarily immigrant labor driving, you know, wage growth and demand growth and filling jobs is a bad thing.
Yeah, and people are raising their job growth estimates in part because of it. Politics aside, it is adding to the job market. And I've seen some estimates that maybe it could be all the jobs that have been added in the last couple of years could be related to that political hot button issue. Tom Lee, long and strong, optimistic as always. Tom, we appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, folks, here's a biggie programming note. We just ran a little bit of a clip. Stick around tonight after Last Call for a 30-minute version of Leaders Steve Cohen, the full interview with the hedge fund titan and owner of the Mets. It's his first ever CNBC interview, or at least first ever in like 20 years. He almost never talks to the media. Cohen, part of the inspiration, by the way, for the TV show Billions. That is a big deal interview. It's right after Last Call, 8 o'clock Eastern. All right, let's take a look at what happened inside the markets today. You know the macro numbers. We showed them to you. The big winner of the day was Paramount, up 15%. And sale talks with Skydance Media heating up. More on that later. The big decliner, Ulta Beauty, the once red-hot stock, down 15% after the CEO warned that consumer demand for beauty products is slowing down. All right, one block down, any more to go. And on deck, Janet Yellen goes to China. Can the Treasury Secretary get anything done? Plus, the potential parallel between Taiwan's massive quake and another natural disaster that ended up rocking financial markets 30 years ago. Kyle Bass up on that. And a rough chapter for Disney is over, but could a tougher one have just begun?
At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
All right, welcome back. Taiwan's eastern coast reeling from the aftermath of a deadly earthquake today, the strongest the island has seen in 25 years. At least 9 are confirmed dead. Many more missing. The 7.4 earthquake triggered tsunami warnings across the region. A Taiwan semiconductor, which makes most of the majority of the major chips for the world, evacuated workers and halted production after the quake. Good news that nobody at the company was injured, and Taiwan Semi expects to fully resume production overnight. But if cracks eventually do show, could it set off a chain reaction? A little bit of a history lesson is in order. Back in 1995, you might remember a huge earthquake upended Kobe, Japan. Quake did massive damage to the Japanese port infrastructure, but it also ended up setting off a chain of events that caused a bit of a regional currency crisis and the ultimate collapse of England's oldest bank, which was called Barings because of bad bets made on currencies. Let's bring in Kyle Bass. He's the founder and chief investment officer of Heyman Capital Management. And amazing and thankful that more people were not killed in this quake. Kyle, it was just an unbelievable. You see some of the tallest buildings in Taiwan swaying back and forth, and many of them thankfully held. But I think my point on 1995, I hope, was relevant because so much of the world is reliant on Taiwan for the most advanced chips. I mean, they basically make all the chips for NVIDIA, Apple, and others that... Could this be a 1995-like event, or at least a warning to people that black swans happen?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, great to be here, Brian. Second of all, I think historical analogs are difficult. You know, there aren't too many similarities. However, here you might be right for the wrong reason, and what I mean by that is you have a scenario where the U.S., a Federal Reserve, and the Treasury. Just pushed 40% inflation to the rest of the world in the last, call it, 3.5 years. And what you'll note if you look around the world, whether you're in Turkey, whether you're in Lebanon or Pakistan or Argentina, you name it, these currencies have hyperinflated, completely fallen apart, meaning lost all savings, the majority of savings, if your savings are in these currencies. What you're seeing, Brian, is that activity, that friction that was just pushed to the world financially is turning into societal friction. And that's why I believe you're seeing the Hamas-Israel conflict. I think it's why you're seeing Russia-Ukraine. I know this, again, this is a broad brush, but all this does is intensify these simmering potential fires.
Yeah.
It intensifies them into larger fires. So here we've got Taiwan with the earthquake. And you know, China has been very belligerent with their military activities around the island of Taiwan, and they've been threatening. In fact, they were at our combatant command headquarters with their informal delegation just last week, threatening us in the Philippines about the Philippines and Taiwan. So now you have a scenario where Taiwan's having its own disaster to deal with, and so you could have a scenario where China decides to do something even more belligerent while Taiwan is having problems with its earthquake.
And the broader point I was trying to make, I think, was, and I'm sure you got this, was the idea of risk management, right? So put back on your investor's hat back, you know, and you think about, to your point, October 7th, right? Hamas. You think about Iran. You think about the strike on the embassy in Syria and how Iran may react. You think about a natural disaster like an earthquake in an area that controls the majority of the advanced chips that are going into some of these stocks like NVIDIA that are trader favorites and are kind of running the entire market. I think the broader point I was trying to make, Kyle, was that you go to bed one way and you can wake up in a very different way. And even for the retailer average investor out there, I think at a time like this, it takes, I hope, it's smart to take a little bit of extra precaution.
Yeah. You know, look, if Taiwan Semi, whether it's a natural disaster or a disaster that was preordained by China's Chinese attack, either one of those would be a real problem for investors in high tech, in advanced generative AI, and in any of these new hyperscale AI data centers. Like the daisy chain of call it disastrous results would be pretty spectacular, as you know, Brian, because there is so much, let's just say, forward expectations. So much of those forward expectations are already discounted in. On the positive side, that there would be a pretty big negative convexity to the negative side if something were to go wrong at Taiwan Semi. To your point, I think we need to be thinking a lot more about risk management in the coming months and years than we had to in the past, especially as it relates to Taiwan Semi.
Yeah, and whether or not it's a natural disaster or intervention, to your point, by Xi Jinping and China, when you got one company that controls that much of that sector, I think just being mindful. Speaking of that area of the world, I want to ask you about this. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen will make her second trip to China this week. She'll meet with top economic officials. Now, did follow a call between President Biden and President Xi yesterday in last week's Beijing Business Summit, where American CEOs like Cristiano Amon of Qualcomm and Blackstone and others met with Xi to further push their investments in China. And I kind of wish this was President Biden going to China rather than sending the proxy in Yellen. If you were going to advise Yellen, if there's one thing she could get from the visit, one big win for us, what would that be?
I mean, look, if you give me the magic wand, I say...
I just gave it to you. You can have the whole thing. You'd have the wizard's cap and the staff. You can have everything.
Look, Brian, in 2013, we signed an MOU with the Chinese securities regulator. The PBOC and SEC signed a CSRC MOU 2013 that said, you know what, China, you are the only country in the world that brings your securities to the United States and lists them here. And you don't have to sit for the audits and have the audit compliance that every other foreign company and U.S. company has to adhere to. We just gave them a pass. And then the SEC magically just gave them another 3-year pass, Brian. It is insane that we give a foreign adversary a pass where they don't have to adhere to real audits. So if I were her, I would demand that. Now, in this case, she's going over there to talk about unfair competition, or let's say excess capacity in factories. And we're really worried about them dumping electric vehicles in the United States and putting our EV business out of business, or at least severely hurting them. One point I'll make, go back to 2018 when the Trump administration put the 232 tariffs on steel. We put tariffs on aluminum. And by the way, the Biden administration said they lobbied against those, and they said, well, we'll repeal those when we get in. By the way, they've never been repealed. Do you know why? When there's a state actor like China acting non-uneconomically to put certain businesses in the U.S. out of business because they want our reliance upon them. Think about this. In aluminum, those were only 10% tariffs. And at the turn of the century, there were 20 primary aluminum smelters in America. Today, there are 4. I don't think the tariffs we put on aluminum were enough. The tariffs on steel still stand. So we're about to get Chinese electric vehicles that are way below the price of ours. And listen, they've got all of the extra sensing equipment. Xi Jinping doesn't allow Teslas anywhere near him or his government because they have all these recording cameras and LiDAR and all the things they've got. Well, we allow all of the Chinese electric vehicles all over our country, and they can just monitor us,
monitor everything. The TikTok of cars is what we'll call it, Kyle Bass.
It's crazy.
And by the way, the president wants the UAW vote. He wants to protect Detroit. BYD, not good. It's a BFD, I think, if you know what I mean. Kyle Bass, thank you very much.
Nice.
That's
nice
the end of my career. All right, still ahead. A battle won, but another may just be getting underway for Disney. We got the great Jeff Sonnenfeld, who braved the weather to come down from Yale on set with Ken Squire next.
At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
All right, welcome back. Let's get to tomorrow's news tonight. And Tom Cruise may finally find a forever home. Paramount entering exclusive merger talks with David Ellison's Skydance Media as a result, putting further discussions with Apollo Global Management on ice, at least for the next month. The Wall Street Journal reporting Apollo made a $26 billion all-cash offer for Paramount over the weekend, evidently not high enough. That news sending shares of Paramount higher today by a lot. It was the best performing stock, I think, in the S&P 500. All right, staying with media. The battle for Disney's soul apparently has been won, and the House of Mouse prevails. Despite the best efforts of billionaire investor Nelson Peltz, Disney shareholders approve the board members backed by company leadership. CEO Bob Iger thanked shareholders for their support in a release immediately following the decision. But investors did not appear that excited about the news, shares actually closing down just over 3% today. Peltz's firm, it's called Trian, released a statement following the decision saying in part, quote, "While we are disappointed with the outcome of this proxy contest, we are proud of the impact we have had in refocusing this company on value creation and good governance." Disney's challenges, though, may be far from over. Where does the company go from here? Joining us tonight, on set, Yale School of Management Senior Associate Dean Jeffrey Sonnenfeld and 13D Monitor founder and president Ken Squire, both CBC contributors, both somehow survived what can only be described as a monsoon. Is it fair to say in New Jersey we have a monsoon going on right
now? It's a monsoon.
It was a girl on a bike with a dog in the basket. She flew by me, almost hit by car. I'm glad you're both here. Jeff, a big win for Bob Iger.
Was she calling for Ant-M?
Not yet. It could be later. Big win for Iger.
A huge win for Iger. It's a great triumph. It actually is a crushing blow, of course, to Nelson Peltz and maybe deactivates a lot of the activist fervor that's been out there in recent years. Is to win with the 70% of the vote. I think this is, many of his enthusiasts were surprised at just what a great victory this was. And it shows that Bob Iger truly is the magician, the great wizard of the Magic Kingdom, whereas the cheap parlor tricks were coming from Nelson Peltz, the illusionist who was always distracting and deflecting from his own performance as a failing financier.
He's a billionaire. I mean, if I fail, yeah. I'd like to fail and become a billionaire. Well, I'll take it.
His investors aren't billionaires, though.
No,
he's lost 40% of his investors.
Himself.
Well, he makes it off the fees. But when he has, of the boards he served on, 70% of them are dramatically below the S&P. The Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times have all confirmed the same thing, that going back 5, 10, 15 years, this guy, his holdings are consistently below the S&P by more than 5%, some by 20%. This is, this guy's circling the drain. He had to shut down his EU operation. His son-in-law quit the firm. And this could be the end of Nelson Peltz. No responsible institutional investor could throw themselves behind him.
He's still got 40% of the vote. I mean, Disney got 60, Peltz got 40. Aside from that, do you think Peltz did make a mistake? As successful as he might, Nelson himself is rich. Do you think that he made a mistake in making this about Bob Iger and less about Disney?
I do, but I don't want to jump on Nelson. Let's respond to a little bit of what Professor Sonnenfeld was saying. First of all, the S&P 500 is, as we know, an irrelevant benchmark these days with FANG, and no real investor uses the S&P 500 as a benchmark.
You just obliterated the entire business model of our network.
And if we judged directors on their track record versus the S&P 500, there wouldn't be a single director on a non-tech company out there right now. So let's put that to bed. But I want to just put, if I can, for the viewers, just put a little context around this, around the proxy fight. Every year in the United States, 98% of companies elect a slate of directors that are unopposed. And every year, as a mere formality, those directors are just made the new directors of the board. And that's great. It should be 98%. For whatever reason, shareholders don't have the resources, they don't have the need, they don't have the inclination to oppose these directors, mm-hmm. which is fine. But in rare situations, less than 2% of the time, a shareholder will come along and say, for corporate governance reasons, for performance reasons, for whatever reasons, this is a situation where I'm willing to put up money to give the other shareholders who might think like me a choice. And that's what Nelson Peltz did here.
Yeah.
He gave them a choice. The shareholders from Vanguard down to the smallest retail shareholder were very responsible.
So you think the act is a positive?
It's a total positive, and there's no villains here. This is how we want the markets to run in the limited situations where a shareholder is putting up the money so other shareholders can have a choice in an election.
There is a villain. This is, the $30 million, of his own money that Peltz wasted. He probably could have fed every single living person inside of Gaza for a month. This is a waste of $30 million down the drain. A lot of good things you could have done with it.
You don't think Disney's a perfect company? Do you, Jeff? Do you think Disney's a perfect company? Their last four of their movies last year were absolute bombs.
And those were all greenlit under Bob Chapek. Okay, so that's
so
the
not,
problem.
So maybe it's a Disney issue, not an Iger issue.
The Disney Plus issues definitely happened under Chapek, too, that he was jamming the outlet with a lot of low-quality stuff and way too much stuff. So Iger's been a lot more selective. Iger has an incredible vision for streaming. He's, without doubt, going to be the most successful of the traditional media companies in streaming.
This was never about Bob Iger not being a successful CEO, not being a good visionary. Nelson Peltz was not opposing Bob Iger. And by the way,
He voted against him. He denied it, and it turns out he voted against him, so much for honesty.
He might have withheld his votes against him, but he did not recommend that the other shareholders withhold their votes against him. But to the $30 million issues that he spent, I think he's probably had some consolation that his investors have in the $1 billion that he made on the position from taking this position and seeing it and with the stock.
He sold a third of his own position. This was Ike Perlmutter's money. And this is a stock that's up, the number one Dow stock. You don't want to use S&P? Just look at the Dow. It's the number one Dow stock for the year, which is incredible.
Jeff, it's not about the year. It's about long term. It's about succession. It's about holding the board accountable. It's not about this quarter or last quarter.
This is a board. You can't name right now on this set. You can't name a stronger board in corporate America. Mary Barr of General Motors, Safra Katz.
He didn't oppose them.
Of Oracle.
He didn't oppose them.
Thank you.
This is only about
doing
him.
This a while.
You have been. James Garvin, where's he from?
Morgan Stanley. Master move, I think, putting James Gorman on the board.
Fantastic.
Well, hold on.
Is that the quality of this board, Carolyn Everson of?
This wasn't about James Gorman. This wasn't about Safra Katz. It wasn't about Barra. It was about him versus Mel Lagomasina, who's been on the board for 9 years, who's an impressive person and a good director, but it's about giving the shareholders a choice. The James Gorman
and
move,
she knew
I do
a lot
agree,
about direct-to-consumer. They're lucky to keep her.
A lot of people felt that in a time now when succession is a key issue, that Nelson Peltz might have been a more valuable...
I want to reframe it, because I think Ken's got a good point. Jeff, which is, I know you're, I know you're a Bob Iger fan, and Bob Iger's the first two tenures.
I'm a Ken Squire fan too.
It's a good discussion. It's fair and polite. The first two tenures of Bob Iger, he outperformed almost every major media company. So then he rides off into the sunset. Chapek comes in. I think it's fair to say an unmitigated disaster.
Right.
Okay. Is that fair to say? Stock collapses. It's one of the most retail owned stocks in the world. Iger comes back, stock's up $40 off its lows. But that said, can you agree, Jeff, that Ken's point that maybe Peltz just need to come in and, you know, rattle the cage a little bit? Bob Iger can't be there forever. There has to be somebody else. This is what you do for a living. Who else could?
I've written books on this.
Correct.
Right.
I haven't fostered the bench.
You do interesting things. I've just been doing CEO succession for 40 years. And you're right. There's a bench strength here. You could almost reach randomly into this. Dana Walden in charge of TV that they brought in through the Fox deal.
That's probably
incredible.
Next, right?
Alan Bergman of movies and film. He's incredible. Josh D'Amaro is superb. What he has been doing with parks and recreation parks. They've cut the price of the parks. 15%, whatever. And the parks are soaring. The record highs in their the parks and resorts. Jimmy Pitaro and ESPN. And meanwhile, they brought in a fantastic new star, by the way, to work on the ESPN streaming. Kevin Mayer, who did all these super deals and internationals, an old student of mine back at the evil Harvard days. And Tom Staggs, who
but why? I'm going to make a terrible sports analogy because Bob Iger and Billy Martin have nothing in common. But you remember, you know, Billy Martin, the Yankees coach, every time they'd fire a coach, he would leave, then they would bring Billy Martin back.
Right.
And as great as Bob Iger is, you wonder why wasn't there somebody else they could have brought in? Why did they have to bring
Steve Jobs back?
The difference is that Billy Martin was being hired or fired by George Steinbrenner. Here, Bob Iger is somewhat controlling the situation, which is not a functional succession plan. So Bob Iger came in for 2 years and made the decision he wants to stay another 2 years. Bob Iger shouldn't, as good as he is, as iconic as he is, there needs to be a board succession that leads it, not Bob Iger saying how long he's going to stay.
I wrote a book on this, too, to hawk it, called The Hero's Farewell, for 11 seconds, a bestseller, Oxford University Press, teeny print, hard to read. But in that book, there's one category called The Generals. That's this type. They come back. Their greatest glory is when they're called back from mothballed service. MacArthur, Patton, Montgomery, Second World War, Churchill, yeah. De Gaulle, they were all retired. They came back in. Steve Jobs, Howard Schultz, Michael Dell, they all came back. And guess what? ISS voted against all of them. And Peltz, I'm sure all these guys were against them. And they had terrible first years. They had a couple hundred percent. And after 4 years, none of those guys had the returns that Iger has had, where he's up 30% in his first year.
Hold on. First, two things. First, quickly, did any of them come back for 2 years successive contracts? I'm not sure. And secondly, all of the data that Professor Sonnenfeld keeps saying, it's great for academia, but you know the old saying that if you torture the data long enough, it'll confess to anything.
Show me something wrong with the data.
Guys, this was a...
He wasn't on 22 boards.
This was a great discussion. I'm getting the hook here. How about this?
No, we're just getting started.
I know. We both agree. Disney just needs to make movies that people want to watch. That's it. Just make a nice movie that everybody wants to go see. They'll make money. Everybody's happy. Great discussion. Fair, polite. It's what we do here on Last Call on CNBC. Nobody's screaming and shouting. Guys, thank you. All right. Quick programming note.
Thanks, Jeff.
There you go. Look at that. David Faber sitting down. Oh, my gosh. Bob Iger just popped up with David. They're going to talk tomorrow about where the business goes from here following the successful proxy fight. Tune in, 9 a.m. Eastern. That's a biggie. All right, coming up. To quote the rapper Ginuwine, looking good, plenty tight. Levi's shares rocking after hours. And the reason why may surprise you, the CEO will join us exclusively. That's right, it's an earnings alert. And Levi's reported first quarter results a short time ago, and things looking pretty good in Denimville. A retailer not only beat street expectations, but also raised full-year profit guidance, and Levi's direct-to-consumer business is on fire, accounting for nearly half of overall sales. Shares are getting a boost right now in extended hours trading. Joining us now is our own Courtney. I hate when we say that, our own. Of course, it's Courtney Reagan with the CEO of Levi Strauss in her first interview since assuming the role. I know nothing about jeans, so take it away, Courtney Reagan.
Thank you very much, Brian. Appreciate it. I am joined by Michelle Goss. She is CEO of Levi Strauss & Company, the first female CEO since the company's founding in 1853. I love that fact. You did just finish your first earnings call, and on the call you said you are more confident in the consumer now than you were, say, 3 or 6 months ago, but you also kept your sales forecast for the full year the same. So how do you balance the two?
Well, first, I'd say we are feeling more confident, Courtney, than maybe 3 or 6 months ago, because everything we're looking at feels really good. First of all, the denim category, which, if you take the U.S., our biggest market, after a couple years of volatility, has stabilized. And we'll probably talk about this, but Levi's is gaining share among men and women and youth, the middle-income consumer. So back to that bellwether, the middle-income consumer, their consumption of the category is growing, and Levi's share is growing there. So that's a good backdrop. But I would say, as it relates to our guidance, I mean, we're holding firm at 1% to 3%. We always, of course, want to do better than that. But in terms of our commitments, we're just so early in the year. We felt it was prudent to maintain our current guide on revenue. But as you know, we did increase our profitability guide and our EPS.
And so when you're talking about stabilization, and direct-to-consumer is a really big focus, one of your pillars, but also wholesale is still a big opportunity. You used to run Kohl's, and you were a wholesaler that sold Levi in store. So how do you balance the two, and where are you seeing the stabilization then?
Absolutely. So we're seeing stabilization overall in the category. I mean, denim is having a moment, and I would say Levi's is having a powerful moment around the world. I mean, just look at all this denim that is surrounding us here right now. And to your point, we're seeing phenomenal traction in our direct-to-consumer channel. We were at 8% overall, globally, we're up 10% in the U.S., and then that 8% is 25% on a two-year stack. So the consumer is definitely saying they want Levi's in direct-to-consumer, which is the fullest expression of the brand from head to toe, as well as working with our stylists who are right there in the store, or our e-commerce business, which is on fire. But wholesale continues to be a really important channel for us. It's an amplifier of the brand. It reaches consumers at as many stores as we plan to build over time. We're not going to be in every neighborhood. And we're seeing traction in that channel as well. In the U.S. wholesale channel, which I'm very familiar with, we put a number of initiatives in place last year, and they're working. Our supply chain is stabilized, but really importantly, the product is resonating. Newness, in fashion, newness in fabrication, even newness in non-denim. So we're optimistic really across all channels as we look forward.
And you do find that really interesting. Nike, of course, just sort of came back out and said, look, we're going to re-examine some of these wholesale partnerships because there is value there. So it's interesting to say, yes, you're focused on DTC, but yes, you're not pulling away from the wholesale channel.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right.
And talk about having a moment. I mean, look at Beyonce. She's got this new fabulous country music album, and one of the songs is called Levi's Jeans. What is the Beyonce effect?
Well, I mean, you know, one of the things we like to say at Levi's, the brand is one of our biggest assets. I'd say that and our people. And it's really important that we continue to amplify everything that Levi's represents to consumers. And, you know, this was organic. And, you know, being the center of a culture, is there any better proof point or testament than Beyonce, who is a culture shaper herself, to name a song after us? I mean, we are so humbled. It's a huge honor.
Let's talk a little bit, if we can, in the time we have left, about the different changing denim silhouettes. You and I were sort of talking about this off camera. Where are we in the cycle? Because when a new look or a new silhouette comes out, it obviously drives business. But wider legs, looser jeans, that's been out for a little bit of time.
You
still have some runway to sell those silhouettes.
Yes. Well, first of all, I would say, as we were talking earlier, I think we're just in a denim moment overall. And Levi's, I mean, we're by far the leader in denim. So it's our moment as well. And we're leaning right into that. I think for Levi's, I mean, we've always been famous for jeans. I mean, we've been around for 170 years. Amazing. Yet there's so much runway ahead. And I would say there's two avenues. One is direct to consumer, like we're saying. We have so much opportunity around the world. But then it's really positioning the brand from not just standing for denim bottoms, but taking that denim authority and being all things denim head to toe. And believe it or not, we still have a ton of opportunity in things like denim skirts, denim dresses, tops. I mean, denim skirts and dresses were up over 100% in the quarter. I mean, triple digit numbers, which just says to me, we're scratching the surface. You know, denim is having that moment overall, but this is going to be everlasting for us. And, you know, given the strength of DTC, we're seeing consumers really do want that head-to-toe expression from us.
Well, this was a really interesting interview. There's so many more places we could go, but we're out of time, so stay close. Maybe you'll talk to us next quarter. We can do it on the show or somewhere else on CNBC. Michelle Goss, CEO of Levi Strauss & Company, thank you for joining us. Brian, back over to you.
Great stuff. Courtney, thanks for bringing it to us, as always. All right, coming up, mean to the max. Astounding new numbers around one DJT stock next. Gotta do it. Let's talk about Trump media. Trading around Trump media has been nothing short of surreal. It's not our opinion. MarketWatch broke down Trump media's price to sales ratio. It's a measure that many of you investors use to value stocks. Based on the 2023 sales and outstanding stock, their peak price to sales ratio is 2,147.9 to 1. Just how crazy is that? Well, it dwarfs the peak valuation seen from GameStop and AMC at the height of the meme stock craze in 2021. It's also significantly higher than the recent peak price to sales of the new meme favorite Reddit, which is 12.9 to 1. It's 2,147.9 to 1 or 12.9 to 1. For more on this and other things, market, let's bring in our friend J.J. Kinnan, the CEO of IG North America. I'm not judging the company. Who knows? It could surge in growth. We don't have any idea what's going to happen, but that's a pretty big number.
That's an outrageous number. You know, again, we thought the AMC numbers, et cetera, were outrageous. This is outrageous. Of course, President Trump, because of who he is and his name, does carry a premium with him. I think you have to give something to that. I don't know if it carries quite this premium. At the end of the day, though, what you're hitting on is really the most important thing for investors at home, and that is, you know, earnings drive stocks eventually. You may be able to trade at this really high PE ratio for a while, but eventually you do have to come into line, and even with something of a premium because of the name, you're going to have to come into some sort of line with the rest of the market.
And this is a weird, and I hate politics, so just, but this is, I got, it's facts, right? I mean, it's so, the former president's facing all these massive legal bills. You do wonder, JJ, if people were buying the stock to sort of help him out in a weird way, because if the stock goes up, he might be able to borrow against it. My point is only that there are other things going on with this stock.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think you can discount that either, Brian. Again, almost 50% of the country voted for him. And I think that sometimes people are too quick to dismiss that. Whether you like him or you don't like him personally, to your point, you can't ignore the facts that he had a lot of votes. And because of that, there are going to be people who are going to buy this stock. They see it almost as a contribution to him running for president again. So again, taking the politics away from how you may personally feel, any of us may personally feel, that is a fact that you have to take into account when you're looking at this stock.
Whether it's DJT, GameStop, Reddit, these are risky bets. I think you would agree on that. They may go up, they may go down, who knows. Is there something that you, JJ, you're a market pro forever, some stock out there, not these, just like a normal everyday stock, do you think is undervalued right now?
If I could say one thing about DJT really quickly first, Brian, if you don't mind, because I think it's an important point I wanted to make. And that is those who are trading it, you talked about how it's moving around. It's so, risky. It has a volatility of 185. If you don't trade options, you may not care about that. But what it does mean is that between now and the third week in June, it has a possibility of moving down to $6.
Yep.
Or up to $93. I think it's really important for people to know that and know if they're ready to sort of look at that overall. Yeah. And as far as, what I look at in terms of what I'm seeing for a
quickly, JJ.
Yeah, go ahead, Brian. I will let you go with this. If I look what our clients are buying.
Gotta go. JJ, I got to cut you off, my friend. We'll get you all back on soon, folks. We're back.
Talk right to after you soon,
this. Brian. Thank you. Thanks. Got it. We're back after this. All right, welcome back. If you live in Arizona, your food delivery could soon be dropped off by no one. Instead, the grub could arrive via a driverless car. Uber Eats, teaming up with Alphabet-owned Waymo to launch autonomous vehicle food delivery program limited to select vendors in Phoenix, Chandler, Mesa, and Tempe. Uber Eats, by the way, users can opt for a human driver instead. But with Waymo delivery, standard Uber Eats fees will apply, but you will not be charged for tips. I mean, come on. Robots don't want tips. They want oil. So let's talk more about all of the apparent future of delivery and bring in NBC Bay Area senior investigative reporter Bigad Shaban to break down how all of this works. He's been covering the autonomous vehicle beat in San Francisco. We welcome him back. All right. So is this like a real thing or just a trial that may end up going nowhere?
Hey, Brian, good to be with you. It is real, and if anyone's ever used the Uber Eats app, it's pretty much going to function just about the same way, right? So right now, it's only limited to about 5 or so restaurants in the Phoenix area. So once you go ahead and place your order, the app will actually let you know that there is a chance an autonomous vehicle could be the one bringing you your meal. At that point, you could opt out, or if you want your next meal delivered by a robot car, you opt in, and the app will actually give you the ability to open the trunk of that car once it arrives so you can pull your food out. And actually, it's the same price, whether it's a robot car delivering it or a human. The one difference, again, Brian, is that with these robot cars, you don't have to leave a tip.
Well, a robot might appreciate. You never know. Give him a little pat on the hood or something like this, Bigad. Okay, a lot of questions. I'm sure you have answers. Somebody somewhere is putting food in the trunk. We then go out. We take the food out of the trunk, thus reducing, I would imagine, the risk of anybody, with sticky fingers while they're driving want to sample one of your fries. That's probably a positive. But ultimately, we got to make sure the food arrives hot and fresh. I mean, are they kind of saying you're going to get the same service?
They are. And at this point, Waymo's vehicles aren't equipped with any kind of cooler or heater because they say these are relatively short trips. And actually, Waymo is its main business, of course, has been shuttling around passengers for about the past 7 years or so. This is really their first foray into the food delivery business. Uber, on the other hand, has also been in the driverless car space. But back in 2018, when it was testing one of its vehicles with a human test driver inside, unfortunately, that car was involved in an accident that left a pedestrian dead. So Uber then sold off its business about 2 years later. And their business model now, Brian, is actually relying on other companies already in the autonomous vehicle space, giving them a platform to connect to consumers who want their goods delivered. And Uber Eats has been doing that for about the past 2 years or so. They're now in 7 cities, including Miami, Fairfield outside of DC, Mountain View here in California, Tokyo. So there is a possibility that the company is wanting to expand to other states here, but they're also eyeing other countries where it may make sense to expand globally too.
Go back to your city, San Francisco. I was there a few months ago, saw some of the Waymos riding around, and noticed that one didn't have, let's call it, a perfect launch when the light turned green. I'm just going to leave it there, Big Ad. You know what? You've reported on this, by the way. Where is San Francisco with the driverless taxi? Has it gotten better than some of those early problems with Cruise and Waymo?
You know, this is an interesting time, particularly here in California, right? What's long been known as the tech capital of the universe. But interestingly, California hasn't exactly laid out the welcoming mat for these driverless cars. Certainly regulators and lawmakers have been pretty vocal, Brian, about sharing what they describe as some pretty serious safety concerns. Take Waymo's main competitor, for example, Cruise, which is a subsidiary of General Motors. That driverless car company has actually been off the road for some 6 months now after regulators accused the company of posing an unreasonable risk to passengers. And there's still no timeline on when that fleet will be back on the road. So there's certainly a lot of safety issues that we need to navigate as we continue to see this technology expand in the food delivery service. But I guess one question that remains is, with everyone now expecting a tip, how soon before these driverless cars expect one too?
I wouldn't put it past somebody to slap a fee. Call it a tip, call it what you want, Big Ad. Somebody's going to figure out a way to make more money. Love these reports. It is the future, doing great stuff. Welcome back anytime, Big Ad. Siobhan, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Brian.
Do you know what happened 29 years ago today? Amazon.com made its first sale. It was a book, of course. And it doesn't look like your average bedtime reading, though. The first book sold was called Fluid Concepts and Creative Analogies. Ironically, it was about artificial intelligence. Of course, about 2 years later, Amazon went public, quickly became an e-commerce giant. So if that first Amazon customer liked what he or she saw and bought $10,000 worth of company stock at the IPO and held it, it would be worth $24 million today. That's your last call for tonight. A new episode of CNBC Leaders featuring hedge fund titan Stephen Cohen is next. See you tomorrow.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.